Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Enron, almost 7 years ago now, if you can believe that. Sarbanes-Oxley, a distant memory to some on Wall Street. The subprime meltdown is evidence enough of that. And you might think the time has come for tighter regulation. But then again, you don't sit on the SEC now, do you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by BrandWeek, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives. With real-time coverage, now searchable at BrandWeek.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 7th of July. Great to have you with us. And here we are, the beginning of the end of the rest of the summer. Enjoy it while you can, gang. Congress went back to work today for just a couple of weeks, though, before its August recess and the election. The Bush administration was hard at it over the long holiday weekend. Late Friday, the Securities and Exchange Commission let slip that it's considering some changes to accounting rules that American companies have to live by. Big changes, too, like letting them use foreign accounting standards that sometimes are looser than U.S. regulations. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Former SEC Commissioner Joseph Grunfest says accounting rules are full of complexity and nuance.
U.S. rules are better in some ways. Foreign rules are better in other ways. It's hard to reach the conclusion that one is clearly dominant in all regimes.
But international rules require fewer disclosures about mortgage-backed securities and derivatives, the very investments that triggered the current credit crisis. Southern Methodist University law professor Mark Steinberg is one of many who worry that adopting international standards would roll back reforms passed after the Enron and WorldCom scandals.
The concern is 5 years after Sarbanes-Oxley, here we are introducing more lax rules, not only internationally, but domestically as well.
With the SEC considering allowing U.S. companies to use foreign accounting rules, some people see an industry trying to take last-minute advantage of a business-friendly administration. Lynn Turner, a former chief accountant at the SEC, says the Big Four accounting firms are lobbying hard for the changes.
They know they've got a very friendly ear in Chris Cox, the current SEC chairman, on this issue. So they're pushing to have this adopted before he leaves town with the change in administration.
But Joseph Grunfest, now a corporate governance professor at Stanford, says even if the SEC adopts international standards, later commissions can easily go back to the old rules. The SEC has asked for public comment, but has yet to issue proposed new rules on international standards. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
One more bit of regulatory news before we move on. The SEC and the Federal Reserve wrapped up an information-sharing agreement today. Sounds dull, and maybe it is, but here's the punchline. Bear Stearns, it works something like this. The Fed regulates banks. The SEC keeps an eye on Wall Street investment houses. And the agreement that was announced today is aimed at being able to pick up on structural risks to the system, like Bear Stearns, a whole lot faster than regulators were able to when it happened. Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, there's news of the Microsoft Yahoo variety. Microsoft said today it would consider a new bid for Yahoo if investor Carl Icahn can convince Yahoo shareholders to install a new board of directors. All of this is happening in the run-up to Yahoo's August 1st annual meeting. Speaking of boards, the beer war over Anheuser-Busch is heating up. The Belgian brewer InBev filed papers today to try to oust the entire Anheuser board. It's proposing a new slate, one presumably more open to the $46 billion takeover bid that the Anheuser-Busch incumbents rejected just 2 weeks ago. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
InBev owns shares in Anheuser-Busch, and shareholders can try to remove a company's board. If it seems like an unfriendly tactic, Wim Hoste with KBC Securities says the goal is an amicable resolution.
If it would succeed in changing the composition of AB's board, then that might create another chance of getting to start friendly talks.
InBev says it's taking action because the current board has refused to discuss its offer. But there could be a downside to playing hard. Eric Shepard edits the trade newsletter Beer Marketers Insights.
Employee morale could be hurt quite fiercely in an attempt like this. And if InBev ultimately takes over AB, they'll have to do some smoothing over, I would think.
Anheuser-Busch employees may be left with a bitter taste whether InBev succeeds or not. Dale Osterly teaches at the Moritz School of Law in Ohio. He says in its efforts to ward off the takeover bid, Anheuser-Busch has talked about cutting jobs.
You could be an employee and say, you know, I might be better off under InBev. They're better managers. They'll keep some factories open that it looks like Anheuser-Busch might close.
InBev's threat to unseat the Busch board could be so much froth. Osterly says it may be a bargaining tool to try to get the current board to talk and maybe even consider a higher offer. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Barack Obama was in St. Louis today, home of Anheuser-Busch, of course. He said he thinks it'd be a shame if the InBev deal does go through and Bud winds up with foreign owners. I guess it was only a matter of time before this next item hit the news. With gas and food prices through the roof and consumer confidence in the dumps, malls are starting to feel it. Vacancies at shopping centers around the country have hit a 13-year high, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Almost everything these days seems to stem from the housing crisis. But the mall crisis, if we can call it that, has a more direct connection than most. As Nicholas Vetter with Green Street Advisors puts it,
U.S. strip center development follows rooftops. So wherever there's a new master plan community getting built, you can expect a shopping center developer to put a neighborhood grocery-anchored center there to cater to those customers.
And he says when the housing market turned down and those customers didn't show, the shopping centers were left out to dry. That, combined with plummeting consumer spending, has led to the boom in retail vacancies. The raw number? Almost 300 million square feet of vacant retail space around the country. Reese Incorporated chief economist Sam Chandon says mall owners will have to drop rents to entice new business.
As a potential renter of space in a regional mall, if there are dark spaces, that is going to impact your assessment of how you will perform at the mall to some degree.
Now, for malls, getting customers in the door has everything to do with the anchor store. In a big mall, that could be a big department store like JCPenney. In a little strip mall, it could be a Starbucks. Both of those companies, by the way, have slashed expansion plans for the coming year. Retail analyst Patricia Edwards.
The U.S. right now is overstored. We have too many choices, and it's time to pull back a bit.
Other analysts agree and say retail vacancies will likely get worse before they get better. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Corporate profits are going to be driving the markets tomorrow as Alcoa kicks off the round of second quarter earnings reports. On Wall Street today, though, a whole lot of up and then a bit more down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Detroit's big three car makers aren't really all that big anymore. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler have been losing market share for a while now. Ford and Chrysler seem to have read the writing on the gas at $4 a gallon wall. They've made some pretty deep cuts in jobs and production already. General Motors, though, has been more of the bigger is better mindset, but that might be changing. John Stoll had the story in this morning's Wall Street Journal. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Other big car makers, John, have been trying to right-size themselves for a while now. I saw your story this morning, and the first question that popped into my mind was, what's taken GM so long?
A lot of the reason is because they believed they were going to stay big. Over the last few months, it's been pretty obvious that GM is shrinking at a faster rate than they had initially expected. One is the sales of trucks and SUVs have been really hit hard by $4 gasoline prices, and then the other thing is just the overall economy has been really hard on the auto industry.
So what exactly are you hearing in terms of layoffs and then more structural things are going to do?
On the layoff side of things, it's pretty common knowledge internally that everyone is expecting a broad wave of white-collar buyout type of packages, something that would try to clear out a good percentage. We're talking maybe 10 to 15% of the whole white-collar workforce. That number is not confirmed as of right now, but we do know that it most likely will be in the thousands. On the other side of the envelope here, they're talking very seriously about what to do about their eight brands in North America. As most people know, Hummer is on the block right now. That leaves seven more, and GM seriously taking a look at how legitimate and viable all of those brands competing in the North American market really are.
Let's just pick one just for the heck of it. I mean, GM owns Saab, for crying out loud. How much money do they make doing that?
Well, most analysts would tell you they don't make any money on Saab right now. You're still looking at a pretty high manufacturing cost base because most Saabs are built in Europe. They only sell 35,000. There's a lot of dealers to feed. And when you're talking about going against the BMW or Mercedes, who have much larger economies of scale and can charge more, it's very hard to compete when you're a niche player like Saab.
So what's safe, do you think?
Most people are telling us that Cadillac and Chevrolet are the two brands that GM sees as core to its U.S. approach. Cadillac obviously standing for luxury, the Escalade being the real flagship there, but also their redesigned CTS really hitting the sweet spot in the market. And Chevy is obviously their high-volume brand, selling more than 2 million of those a year. I don't think we're looking at a situation where GM's going to just, you know, cut all the rest of the brands. I mean, you're talking about a company that's in the very initial stages of looking at the viability of brands like Buick, Saab, Saturn, Pontiac, and GMC right now.
I have to ask you about the international market. You know, I just got back from China, and you can't turn around without seeing a Buick over there.
For sure. The Buick story in China is one page out of a pretty good story for GM. I mean, they make money in every market outside of North America right now. They're a little weak in Western Europe, but they're very strong in Latin America, Asia, and Eastern Europe. The reason is that they've had a very aggressive emerging market strategy, and they've been able to utilize a Korean subsidy that they have to build low-cost cars and send them into many of these markets. The U.S. obviously is a different story.
We tried to get GM CEO Rick Wagoner on the phone. The company said he's not talking. You didn't have much luck either, as you note in your article. When are we going to see something concrete, do you think, out of General Motors?
There's a lot of factors right now that the market is looking for indicators from GM on. One of the brands, but more importantly, the structural costs, which speak to the white-collar cuts, and then their ability to raise more financing. And GM's going to have to go out there and look for billions and more dollars to keep this business running through 2010. So that may be the next thing we hear out of them, is how they're going to go about getting that money in a tight market.
John Stoll with the Wall Street Journal in Detroit. John, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks a lot.
All right, so maybe General Motors is behind the curve when it comes to building cars people actually want to buy, but it's on the cutting edge when it comes to selling to one specific demographic. Kyle Norris reports from Detroit.
On the one hand, gay people are a marketer's dream. That's what Joe LaMoralia says. He's publisher of GayWheels.com.
You've got a very high disposable income, a very strong buying power. You have a loyalty factor that most people would kill for.
That buying power is expected to exceed $835 billion within the next 3 years. And car manufacturers are paying attention. But they're doing so in interesting ways.
Let's start your four-minute speed date. The speed dating has started. 4 minutes. Make it happen. Have fun.
Here at Detroit's Motor City Pride Festival, GM is sponsoring a gay speed dating event. Couples sit inside parked GM cars, and they make small talk. And let me say, these cars are sweet. They include a Saturn View, a Saab 9-3 convertible, and a Cadillac Escalade. The speed daters say they definitely noticed that GM sponsored this event. Okay, some were a little more focused on their love matches. But speed dater Keisha Knight says the whole car thing was cool.
Actually, the cars are like ultra sexy. I want to take this one home. I don't know if they let me drive off with it, but if they will, I'll take it.
And that's exactly what GM wants to hear. Adam Bernard is the chairman of GM Plus, the company's resource group for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender employees. He says GM did its homework.
One thing we found in our research is that gay consumers are more likely to buy from a company whose employee practices are positive and supportive of workplace equality. And so that's one of the reasons before we went marketing to the consumer, we made sure all our internal policies were in place. Because then it's kind of hypocritical. If you don't treat your gay employees fairly, then to ask for gay consumers to buy your cars is just rude.
So GM and other car manufacturers offer its employees things like domestic partner benefits. Bernard thinks sponsorship of the speed dating event shows GM values gay people as equals. But still, it's a complicated relationship. Joe LaMoralia says manufacturers understand the positives from a business perspective.
But then there's the emotional side of things where people go, ooh, well, what's gay? I'm not gay. I can't, you know, if we advertise in gay market, does it make us a gay brand? And will that alienate the other people that buy our products?
And that fear of backlash is based in reality. In 2006, Ford placed ads in a gay magazine and got hit with a very public boycott from a Christian organization called the American Family Association. So today, manufacturers are reaching out to gay consumers in more subtle ways. Toyota is doing it from the inside out, with a gay employee resource group. And Ford is promoting one of its designers of the new Ford Flex to the gay media. Through these subtle campaigns, car companies ultimately hope to prove their gay street cred and connect with a group of consumers ready and willing to spend a whole lot of cash. In Detroit, I'm Kyle Norris for Marketplace.
Coming up, the American car industry gets help from an unlikely source.
If you don't have a manufacturing platform in China, you are more than likely on a path to extinction.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials moved down 0.5% today, 56 points, to close at 11,231. The NASDAQ inched down less than 0.1%, just 2 points, finished at 2243. The S&P 500 declined 0.8%, 10 points, ended the day at 1252. Stocks hit the skids early after Lehman Brothers said Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae may need to raise a combined $75 billion to meet new accounting standards. Freddie Mac plummeted 17%. Fannie Mae tumbled 16%. The messenger took a bullet, too. Lehman fell almost 9% today. Microsoft's willingness to reopen talks with Yahoo sent the search company shares 12% higher. Microsoft nudged up 0.2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.9%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board releases the Consumer Credit Report for May. President Bush is in Japan for day two of the G8 summit. And on July 8, 1776, the Liberty Bell rang, gathering Philadelphia citizens for the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The American Academy of Pediatrics made a recommendation today that's turning some heads, that kids as young as 8 years old take drugs to lower their cholesterol levels if diets don't do the trick. With some of the most popular cholesterol drugs losing patent protection in a couple of years and thus getting stiff competition from generics, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now on whether kids with high cholesterol might be the next big market for big pharma.
Some drug makers do see kids as a profitable new market. Dr. J. Lyle Bootman is dean of the University of Arizona College of Pharmacy.
10 years ago, there were no companies developed aimed at drugs for children. Now there are a few companies that have popped up.
So are Saturday morning cartoons going to start including commercials like this?
While we were building our life,
something else was building in my arteries. Dangerous plaque.
About 30% of American children are overweight or obese. But Morningstar health industry analyst Debbie Wong says drug makers will be cautious about marketing cholesterol-lowering drugs for kids.
I don't think it's going to be a huge boon to the industry. There are too many questions left about whether once you put a 10-year-old on one of these drugs, do they keep taking it forever?
That would be nice for Pfizer. It makes the cholesterol-lowering drug Lipitor. It's the best-selling drug in the world, with nearly $13 billion in annual sales. Its patent protection from generic competition ends completely in 2011. Could Pfizer tweak Lipitor, making a special drug for kids that could be patented? Gustav Ando is a pharmaceutical industry analyst with Global Insight. He says probably not. These drugs have already been honed to perfection.
They're so damn good, to be honest. So they're sort of almost a victim of their own success, because it's actually very difficult to improve upon them.
Ando says cholesterol-lowering drugs won't become routine for kids anytime soon, certainly not before Lipitor succumbs to generic competition. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
You can add summer camp to the list of businesses being hurt by the sluggish economy. Industry experts say camps are registering fewer kids this summer, and their parents aren't shelling out to send them away for as many weeks either. Granted, camps aren't as big a deal as, say, housing or oil, but commentator Benjamin Barber says he's heard of one camp that might actually help the economy.
Worried your kid can't get into sports camp? Listen to Becky Ross of Louisville, Kentucky, who declared recently, "Not everybody can be a cheerleader or a football player, so here's something for someone with different interests." That something is a shopping camp at the Summit Mall in Louisville, a fashion camp for girls. And Ross, who's the camp coordinator, says not to worry. It's not really about fashion or designing clothes. It's about how to put together and accessorize outfits. It's about personal development and self-confidence. In short, it's camp at the mall, where, announces the camp ad, you will visit stores that teach lessons in organization, the Office Depot, how to find information, Barnes & Noble, and the importance of thank you notes, Hallmark. Yep, and the day ends with a graduation ceremony where campers receive a certificate and goodie bag that includes a $40 Summit Mall gift. If this all makes you want to, well, throw up in your shopping bag, please don't. Because there's a serious side, too. I mean, some six-year-olds might not think going to the Office Depot is their idea of summer fun. But they're going to be America's Plan B when the Bush stimulus check plan fails. If we can get every other kid in the country into shopping camp this summer, goodbye recession. On the Jezebel website devoted to celebrity, sex, and fashion without airbrushing, cynical bloggers wrote stuff about the fashion camp like, "Now you pay to shop." And, "I'm pretty sure my mom's behind this." And, "My soul just died a little." Well, I say it's time kids figured out patriotism is their thing, too. After 9/11, President Bush reminded Americans that the way to be part of the war on terrorism was to get back to the mall. So why not the kids, too? After all, consumerism's way too important to be left to the grown-ups.
Benjamin Barber is with the New York think tank Demos. You can tell us how you spent your summer vacation, or how you're spending it, actually. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. There just might be a silver lining in the General Motors news we were telling you about earlier, that GM's contemplating more layoffs and shutting down some of its production lines. The good news for the Rust Belt comes in the form of investment. Investment from a country more often seen as a competitor than a friend. Our China correspondent Scott Tong took a side trip to Ypsilanti, Michigan.
When the big three automakers start ailing, the entire supply chain gets infected. Slumping sales have hit companies like American Broach and Machine in Ypsilanti. The company makes metal cutting equipment for transmission and brake parts, and it's been in Brad Kochmeyer's family for decades.
We were focusing on the U.S. market a little bit too much in the automotive, and as orders weren't coming in, we were kind of just scratching our heads looking, where's our next order going to come from?
Enter Qingchuan, a machine tool company from middle of nowhere China. A few years back, Qingchuan bought 60% of American Broach, keeping it afloat and ponying up for Kochmeyer's new factory.
This is a gear grinder that was manufactured by our partner company in China. It was on their floor about 4 or 5 months ago.
In the auto supply sector, only a few Chinese firms have bought American counterparts. For now, a lot of observers see a wave of merger activity about to hit the shores of the industrial Midwest.
Basically, what's in it for the U.S. companies is survival.
Supply chain consultant Francis Basolino is with the firm Alaris.
If you don't have a manufacturing platform in China, you are more than likely on a path to extinction.
If the motivation for struggling U.S. firms is obvious, what's in it for the Chinese buyers? For one, American know-how, innovation. That's hard to come by in China, where the mean joke is that R&D stands for receive and duplicate. Now, the more grown-up term is reverse engineering. Ming-An Tan of the Detroit Chinese Business Association explains.
Basically, you have something existing. More or less, you copy it in a way without fully understanding. Just take it and assume it will work.
Tan gets lots of calls from Chinese auto companies looking for distressed Michigan assets to buy. The other thing they're after is access to the American market, i.e. the Rolodex of Ypsilanti businessman Brad Kochmeyer.
We had very good connections at General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, John Deere, Caterpillar. So we were able to get them into factories that they normally wouldn't have been able to get into and at least introduce their products.
It's a marriage of economic convenience and matchmakers in the form of American lawyers and investment bankers and private equity funds are all trying to arrange more. But can the corporate newlyweds live together?
Mr. Stevenson, how do you think things are going at the factory?
The 1986 film Gung Ho, starring Michael Keaton, provides a bad case scenario. It captures the corporate culture clash between a Pennsylvania factory manager and his new Japanese bosses.
See, you're stateside now, fellas, and tell you the truth, you're still acting like a bunch of Yokohama mamas. No offense. I do not understand American workers. They come 5 minutes late, leave 2 minutes early. They stay home when they are sick. They put themselves above company.
Growing pains aside, China may be the new Japan Inc. as far as investing in America. And here in Autoland, Chinese buyers and American sellers wonder if joining forces will be a viable crossover vehicle in the global economy. In Ypsilanti, Michigan, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go, with yesterday's crazy men's Wimbledon final behind us and the Olympics a month or so away, a commentary on the economics of professional sports in the United States. Last week, Washington Wizards basketball star Gilbert Arenas turned down a contract worth $127 million over 6 years. He agreed to $111 million instead on the team's promise that it would spend the difference to assemble a championship-winning roster. The Washington Post quotes Arenas as saying, "College for his kids is expensive, but it's not that dang expensive." Anywho, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this first Monday in July. Today, the Dow dropped 56 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ lost 2 points, that's 0.1%. The S&P 500 fell 10 points, 0.8% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, landowners are getting steamed over natural gas drilling.
What started as dozens of people turned out then to hundreds of people, which then turned out to thousands of people.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.